My name is Anthony King, and I'm telling the stories behind your favorite cop movies. This is the all-new Neon Badges. Morton Friedgood, otherwise known as John Gotti, was a novelist from New York City who had achieved success with his novels The Thrill a Minute with Jack Albany, Never Put Off Till Tomorrow What You Can Kill Today, and The Three Worlds of Johnny Handsome. The stories he had written around the character of Jack Albany were adapted into a 1968 live-action Disney film starring Dick Van Dyke called Never a Dull Moment. Gotti started working on his next novel, a thriller based around the hijacking of a New York City subway train called The Taking of Pelham 123. Before it was even finished, the story was optioned for a screenplay, and in fact, before Pelham was published in 1973, the film was deep in pre-production. For the screenplay, producers tapped playwright Peter Stone. Stone had found success on Broadway as the librettist for musicals such as Keen, Skyscraper, 1776, and 2x2, as well as writing the screenplays for films like Charade, starring Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, and another Grant film, Father Goose. With Gotti's novel as a template, Stone made a few changes for the film adaptation. Mr. Green's sneeze, for instance, was lifted from Stone's script for Charade. He also had the ability to make the story more cinematic and did away with all of the inner monologues of the train passengers that feature heavily in the novel. And he added one of the most memorable characters from the film, Rico, as played by Jerry Stiller. Keeping Pelham set in New York City was crucial, as it has become one of the definitive New York City movies. As Hector Elizondo put it, New York City was on its knees in the 70s. It survived because it had thick skin, and sang of the subway where most of the story took place, and the subway station? It was another world. During this time period, New York was known as Fun City, and films set in the city sort of became their own subgenre known as Dirty Old New York movies. Films like Midnight Cowboy, The Incident, Coogan's Bluff, Bananas, The Out-of-Towners, and Serpico showed New York as it truly was in the late 60s and early 70s. Towards the end of the 70s, films like Woody Allen's Manhattan and Walter Hill's The Warriors signaled the end of the dirty old New York movie era. This was also the time period where a specific type of disaster movie came into popularity. Airport, The Poseidon Adventure, Juggernaut, Black Sunday, The Big Bus, Two Minute Warning, Roller Coaster, and Skyjack. And later on, of course, Die Hard, which spawned several of its own ripoffs.
Will you guys get a fight for us? But damn it, don't fight against us! Leave us alone! How many more sacrifices? How much more blood? How many more lives?
Giuseppe Daniel Sorgente, better known as Joseph Sargent, had started his career in Hollywood in front of the camera, appearing in dozens of television shows, including The Twilight Zone, Peter Gunn, and The Lone Ranger, as well as a handful of movies. But by the early 60s, he stepped behind the camera and found a knack for directing. Sargent quickly became a sought-after director for television shows like Lassie, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Gunsmoke, and Star Trek. With time spent in the director's chair, Sargent developed a style all his own, his signature being able to make a TV program very cinematic. He also became known as someone who was very progressive in putting together multi-ethnic, multi-gender casts. In 1968, Sargent directed his first feature, The Hell with Heroes, starring Rod Taylor and Claudia Cardinale, and followed that with Colossus, The Forbin Project in 1970. 2 years later, Sargent directed James Earl Jones in The Man, about a designated survivor becoming the first African-American president, and followed that with Burt Reynolds as an ex-con who helps federal agents track down moonshine runners and white lightning.
Bet this machine outrun about anything, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Motorcycles and state police cars. Just about anything on the road.
It's a hot car.
It's tuned up fine, huh?
Only two things in the world I'm scared of.
Only scared of two things? What's that?
Women and the police.
Women and the police.
You spend all your time trying to hump them both, don't you?
Yeah.
So now it was time for Sargent to start assembling his crew. For a cinematographer, Sargent needed someone who knew how to shoot New York City and all its nuances. He could think of no better example of this than The French Connection. Enter Owen Roisman. In The French Connection, Roisman was responsible for the brilliant shots in the streets of New York where he used a lightweight camera on a wheelchair. Roisman had also shot Play It Again, Sam, the Herbert Ross film based on the Woody Allen play, Elaine May's The Heartbreak Kid, and Friedkin's second masterpiece in a string of three in the 70s, The Exorcist. After Pelham, Roizman would go on to shoot films like Network, Tootsie, and The Addams Family. Jerry Greenberg, another Friedkin regular, was recommended to Sargent to cut the film. He'd cut The Boys in the Band and The French Connection for Friedkin, as well as They Might Be Giants and Electra Glide in Blue. He'd also go on as the editor of some little films like Apocalypse Now, Kramer vs. Kramer, Heaven's Gate, and Scarface. For Seth, Sargent turned to Herbert Mulligan, who had worked on Woody Allen's Bananas and Arthur Hiller's The Hospital. Fresh off Cops and Robbers, Gene Rudolph was hired for art direction. And you have Anna Hill Johnstone as the costume designer who designed the looks for East of Eden, A Face in the Crowd, Alice's Restaurant, The Godfather, and Serpico, among dozens of other films. Now it came time to cast. The Taking of Pelham 123 has a standard protagonist-antagonist setup. One good guy surrounded by supporting characters, and one bad guy surrounded by his supporting characters. This film is the only time our two leads appear together in a film. 8 years earlier, though, one had beaten the other for the Best Supporting Oscar. I'm of course talking about Walter Matthau as Transit Police Lieutenant Zach Garber, and Robert Shaw as Bernard Ryder, aka Mr. Blue. Walter Matthau was born and bred a New Yorker. Raised by Jewish immigrants, he developed a sense of humor early, which carried him through his storied career, though this aspect of his personality wasn't too prominent in his early roles. After fighting in World War II with the U.S. Army Air Forces as a radioman gunner, Matthau trained in acting at the Dramatic Workshop of the New School in New York. In the early 50s, he started appearing on stage and screen and quickly started landing more and more roles on television on shows like Shadow of the Cloak, Lux Video Theater, Studio One in Hollywood, and Danger. In 1955, he appeared on the big screen for the first time alongside star and director Burt Lancaster in The Kentuckian. After that, Matthau steadily got more and more work in TV and film, with stuff like Elia Kazan's A Face in the Crowd, Michael Curtiz's King Creole with Elvis Presley, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Stanley Donen's Charade, and in 1966, Matthau appeared in his first of many Billy Wilder films, The Fortune Cookie, a role which earned him the Best Supporting Actor Oscar, an award for which his future co-star would also be nominated the same year. Matthau was now a leading man, landing roles in films like Wilder's The Odd Couple, Hello Dolly opposite Babs, Elaine May's A New Leaf, and Don Siegel's Charlie Varick.
Hey! Are you a hard man to reach? I'll make a deal with you.
You're hardly in any position to make a deal.
Smell like gasoline?
Oh, I bet this thing would burn in a hurry.
I know where the money is. You'll never find it without my help.
Your end is what?
Just help me out of here and let me go.
Where's the money?
We got a deal.
Money first.
Get the keys out of my pocket. I can't move my arm. Now, you see that blue Chevy over there?
Yeah.
The money is in the trunk. Well, I'll be back.
So Matthau got the script, he read it, and loved it. One thing bugged him, though. It was too obscene. Not something Matthau was comfortable with. But he wanted the role of Garber. The other thing was, the role was initially quite a bit smaller than we now know. So Stone and Sargent rewrote the script, expanded the role of Garber, and cut out most of the obscene language. Sargent and company thought Walter Matthau could bring a realness to this film. For one, he looked like a real person as opposed to a glamorized movie star. And Sargent just knew that the humor within the script and the inevitable humor from Matthau off camera would keep his sanity. Hector Elizondo remembers Matthau being very persuasive, very funny, and very smart. You could sense the experience oozing out of him, he said. Now, like Walter Matthau, Robert Shaw was a classically trained actor who served in England's Royal Air Force. Shaw made his West End debut in 1952 at the Embassy Theater in William Douglas Holmes' Caro William. He started to get bit parts on British television, and in 1957 landed his biggest role to date as Captain Dan Tempest on the television series The Buccaneers. Shaw continued to work steadily between the big screen, the small screen, and the stage, and in 1963 got the opportunity of a lifetime with the role of Red Grant, the Spectre assassin opposite Sean Connery's James Bond in From Russia with Love. On top of acting, Shaw was also an accomplished novelist with books like The Hiding Place, The Sun Doctor, for which he was awarded the Hawthorne Prize, and a trilogy of novels, The Flag, The Man in the Glass Booth, and A Card from Morocco. In 1965, Shaw starred alongside Henry Fonda and Robert Ryan in Battle of the Bulge, and in 1966 earned himself an Oscar nomination, which he lost to Matthau, with his role in Fred Zinnemann's Henry VIII drama, A Man for All Seasons.
What an evening. A man could fight a lion. Eh?
Some men could, Your Grace. Thomas, touching this matter of my divorce, have you thought of it since we last spoke?
Of little else.
Then you see your way clear to me?
That you should put away Queen Catherine's sire. Oh, alas, as I think of it, I see so clearly that I cannot come with Your Grace that my endeavor is not to think of it at all.
Then you haven't thought enough!
In Pelham, Matthau's character of Zack Garber would have a couple key supporting characters around him. The first being Frank Correll, the brash, loudmouth leader of the Dispatch Center, played by Dick O'Neill, probably best known by his work in television. The second key supporting actor was one that Peter Stone created for the film, that of Police Lieutenant Rico Patrone, Garber's colleague in the Transit Authority police force, which would be played by Jerry Stiller, best known for his TV appearances and comedy duel with his wife, Ann Mira. The group of hijackers, led by Robert Shaw's Mr. Blue, would be comprised of three other men: Mr. Green, played by Marty Balsam, Mr. Gray, played by Hector Elizondo, and Mr. Brown, played by Earl Hindeman. Balsam had already made a name for himself in films like Sidney Lumet's 12 Angry Men as Juror Number 1, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho as Detective Milton Arbogast, as well as Sargent's movie The Man. Hector Elizondo had primarily been doing theater before Pelham. He'd never really been cast as a loose cannon before, so he was called in to meet with Sargent and walked out with the job that afternoon. And Earl Hindman, who you know as Tim Taylor's neighbor Wilson on Home Improvement, had just wrapped shooting Alan J. Pakula's The Parallax View starring Warren Beatty just before taking the role of Brown. Remembering Robert Shaw, Elizondo said, "Robert had such a competitive spirit. It was very off-putting, but he was a catalyst in that way." And, in fact, Shaw was so competitive that he had a ping-pong table on set, and during breaks in filming, he could be seen taking on challengers on the train station's concourse, badly defeating anyone that took him on. Elizondo called Marty Balsam a dear heart and found something soulful about him. And, for better or worse, of Earl Hindman, Elizondo said he was quiet, unassuming, and always quietly there.
Hi-ho, neighbor!
Other names or faces you might recognize in smaller roles were James Broderick, the father of Matthew Broderick, as the motorman of Pelham 123, Tony Roberts as the mayor's advisor, and really the only glamorous-looking actor in the film, and Doris Roberts from Everybody Loves Raymond fame as the mayor's wife. Editor Jerry Greenberg said that Matthau and Balsam, two guys known for their comic timing at this point in their careers, knew how to take these serious roles in a serious movie and add in their own comic nuances. Joseph Sargent says it was a hell of a cast. Though the dispatch center in the film was a set built at a studio, the rest of the movie is shot on location in the streets of New York, Gracie Mansion, and most importantly, the subway. At first, the Transit Authority absolutely refused to allow the film to be shot in the actual tunnels. Their reason was because they feared someone might see the film and actually try to hijack a subway train. Producer Stephen Keston persisted, though, that no other subway system would do. It had to be New York City. So after Mayor John Lindsay stepped in, production was allowed to begin underground with the caveat that United Artists buy anti-hijacking insurance for $75,000 and pay the Transit Authority $275,000 to use their property. In the credits at the end of the film, it says,
"Although many of the scenes in this film were taken on transit property, the New York City Transit Authority is not responsible for the plot, story, and characters portrayed. The authority did not render technical advice and assistance."
So the MTA opened up the decommissioned Court Street station in downtown Brooklyn, which is now the New York Transit Museum, for production. And shooting began in November of 1973. Hell on Earth! That's how Joseph Sargent recalled shooting in the tunnels. "We were in a black hole for 8 of the 10 weeks we shot. It was the most trying experience I've ever had to go through." Now, keep in mind, they were in a tunnel that hadn't been used since the 1940s. On top of the dust and flotsam and jetsam that had built up after 30 years of being stagnant, you had everything that built up over the years while it was still functioning. Every time we moved the train, there was 70 to 100 years of dust that raised up and wiped out your throat. We all had to wear surgical masks. I'm surprised we all came out of it alive, remembered Sargent. The air was so dangerous underground that if you weren't in front of a rolling camera, you had to wear a mask to protect yourself. Sounds familiar, right? Now imagine working under these conditions. Underground, little to no light, for 16 hours a day. It'd be like working in a coal mine. Everyone remembers the shock of walking out into daylight after spending the entire day underground. It'd be like Dracula catching a ray of sunlight. On top of the gloominess and the unbreathable air, you also had the constant fear of the third rail, the rail of the subway that supplied all the electricity needed to make the trains run. Now, just because the tunnel was decommissioned didn't mean people were jumping at the chance to touch the third rail just to make sure it was dead. So what the crew ended up doing was they laid a chain over the electrified rail. So if by chance someone in the control room accidentally threw the wrong switch, shooting electricity coursing through the third rail while they were shooting, it shorted out immediately. Still, nobody actually touched the rail until the time they came for Mr. Blue to get electrified. They just rolled camera, called action, and prayed that Robert Shaw wouldn't kill himself when he put his foot to it. Obviously, conditions weren't great underground. The Transit Authority still ran nearby trains whose noise would disrupt filming several times a day. Production wasn't even given enough cars that would allow the train to go as fast as they needed it to go. So any shot of speeding trains we see in the film was shot one Saturday night in an 8-hour period allotted by the MTA, which I'll speak to more in a minute. The dressing rooms were fabricated lean-tos essentially with no ceiling. Hector Elizondo recalls the extremely close quarters and says, "We really got to know each other. It was freezing, it was dusty, it was noisy." Sargent said, "Pelham was more or less like Jaws must have been for Steven Spielberg. But through it all, Sargent pushed through." Elizondo says, "Nothing seemed to rattle him. He was a good captain." Sargent insisted that the film be shot in widescreen, so for that he turned to Panavision. Now, Panavision is a company that supplies cameras and lenses for movie productions for rental only. You've seen that logo in many of your favorite movies. They were, and still are in some respect, on the cutting edge of developing new ways to shoot movies. So Sargent insisted on shooting widescreen to assist in the feeling of confined spaces and show how little room there really was, especially in the subway car. For instance, a common widescreen aspect ratio used for many films is 1.85:1, but Pelham was shot in 2.35:1. In layman's terms, the wider the aspect ratio, the bigger the black bars on top and bottom of the screen. It gets even wider, too. You can get the Ultra Panavision 70, which has an aspect ratio of 2.76:1. Films like Ben-Hur and The Hateful Eight use this. The wider the ratio, the more beautiful your sweeping landscape shots will be. And only the greatest filmmakers in the world can shoot in 2.35:1 or 2.76:1 and get those beautiful wide shots as well as insanely perfect close-ups. So Sargent insisted on 2.35:1 to add to the claustrophobia, but this created unique difficulties for cinematographer Owen Roizman. For one, they were using a two-camera setup on the subway car. Roizman was tasked with figuring out how to get two cameras shooting in widescreen at the exact same time in this thin, long tube to where they couldn't see each other. Editor Jerry Greenberg recalls Roizman dropping off film constantly, saying, "I don't know how the fuck I'm doing this," because of the space in which he was shooting. And speaking of editing, so much of the film was being produced day in and day out that Joe Sargent couldn't be involved in the cutting process immediately. Greenberg needed another set of hands and eyes, so he called in his friend Robert Lovett, who had cut Cotton Comes to Harlem a few years prior. And yet, they still didn't have enough footage. So Greenberg and Lovett, the editors, are the ones who went out and shot the second unit of the subway cars speeding by that Saturday night. With seemingly everything stacked against them, it didn't seem like this film was going to see the light of day. Still, though, Sargent powered forward. So, we know how this ends, right? The movie gets made and eventually becomes a beloved classic. So let's take a break from the stress of it all and point out some favorite moments from the film itself. Notice Walter Matthau's wardrobe. Again, brilliantly designed and styled by the incomparable Anna Hill Johnstone. Garber is wearing a brilliantly flamboyant plaid shirt with oranges and reds and yellows with a bright banana yellow tie. This is the first and really only pop of color in the film. It helps offset the doom and gloom in the tunnels. And then this moment here.
Hey! You listen to me, you dumb son of a bitch. You don't do what I tell you, you'll be having dinner tonight with Kaz Dolowitz.
Jesus Christ, what are you...
Zack starts to become unhinged towards Carell and grabs him by the collar and throws him down, crashing to the floor. The way it was supposed to go was that Matthau was to grab O'Neill by the shirt and then just aggressively let him go. O'Neill wasn't supposed to fall back into the chair, knock it over, then fall on his ass. It was a genuine mistake. You could see the look of shock on Dick O'Neill's face and Walter Matthau reaching down to help him up before the camera cuts away. It was so real, though, that Sargent decided to leave it in the film. Now let's talk about the brilliant score from David Shire. You may not know his name, but I have no doubt that you've heard David Shire's compositions. The Conversation, All the President's Men, Norma Rae, Return to Oz, Short Circuit, Zodiac, and dozens more. over 150. Shire knew what kind of sound he wanted. He just didn't know how to get there, though. He wanted more of a jazzy score with a touch of Latin influence. Usually, Shire works mostly from improvisation. He sits at the piano and just lets his fingers go. The creative process was really interesting, he says. This never happened on any other picture I've worked on. He sat at his piano, let his fingers go, and the only thing that came out were these broken, dissonant motifs. Then Shire recalled a conversation he had with his colleague Paul Glass about atonal music. At that time, Shire just couldn't get into it. His brain worked in a more melodic manner. But he started to experiment with those dissonant tones, and he started working with 12-tone rows. Now, a tone row is a set of notes that you play, a scale, for example, but you can't repeat any of those notes until all of those notes in the row have been played. A 12-tone row uses this theory, but incorporates every note in the scale. So in essence, you can create a unique melody, the likes of which have never been heard by any living creature. This is how David Shire composed the theme to The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. And then for the orchestra, Shire had a preponderance of low instruments, like a contrabass saxophone and bass clarinets, and several high instruments, like flutes and trumpets, but no mid-range instruments, like violas. It came out sort of like a crazy quilt of everything I wanted, he said, calling it controlled music that sounds chaotic. And after completing the main title, he says it was just pure fun. Joseph Sargent calls scoring a collaborative art. Just hope the composer can catch whatever it is you're putting on screen. Opened on October 2nd, 1974 to great critical acclaim. The public, on the other hand, didn't fall for it. Joe Sargent was dismayed by the marketing strategy. The marketing was so mishandled by using a comic book-like poster that made it seem like a cheap exploitation film, he said. Everyone expected it to make a lot of money. Lines were wrapped around the corner at theaters in New York City. In other cities like Toronto, London, and Paris, it did great at the box office. Elsewhere, it was considered a flop. Take a look for a second at what all those bigger cities have in common. Large subway systems. Still, though, with a $5 million budget, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 grossed $16.5 million. Dave Kerr of the Chicago Reader called it a superior exercise in urban paranoia. He says the superb location work of director Joseph Sargent goes a long way toward tempering the artificialities of the plot. John H. Dorff, the Hollywood Reporter, said the film is surefire entertainment, gripping, exciting, and humanly funny from beginning to end. With a clear conception of contemporary values, Joseph Sargent has directed the best of multiple Jeopardy pictures to date. Sargent's accomplishment is in his deft establishment of interesting, full-dimensioned characters described in a single gesture or line of dialogue without slowing down the story. Sargent's straightforward action direction and the skilled juggling of editors Gerald Greenberg and Robert Q. Lovett keep the pitch of excitement high and constantly in motion. Walter Matthau, whose wonderfully weary sense of irony is perfect for the head of the Transit Authority Police. Owen Roisman contributed solid, practical photography under challenging location conditions. Gene Rudolph's Transit Authority is an authentically organized physical layout. The sensibly deployed music of David Shire keeps visceral excitement high, as does the charged level of mixer Chris Newman's sound. And, of course, Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times with 3 out of 4 stars. When The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 first appeared as a novel, I avoided it on reasonable grounds that A, there was no plausible way to hijack a subway train, and B, if there was, it would be so obvious that it wouldn't be interesting. The movie's plot inclines toward B. The gang has a good sound plan, not too complicated, and they almost get away with it. But the movie's appeal, which is considerable, doesn't depend on the plan or on easily foreseeable plot. It depends instead on a nice feel for New York City and some fine detailed performances. Walter Matthau is gruff, shaggy, and sardonic as a Transit Authority lieutenant. Robert Shaw is clipped and cruel, and the supporting performances are allowed to grow and take on personality. These aren't machine-made genre characters, but individuals, and more specifically, New Yorkers with gallows humor, paranoia, warmth, and resiliency. The passengers may have been cast according to their stereotype titles, but in the movie, they're just a car full of scared people. They're handled convincingly, and the details of the hijack are worked out in a straightforward, plausible way. The film concentrates on the communications between Walter Matthau trying to buy time and Robert Shaw maintaining credibility. We don't have to endure a series of airport-style vignettes in which a pregnant woman goes into labor, a guitar-playing nun cheers people up, etc. What's good about Pelham's example of the form is that the performances are allowed enough leeway so that we care enough about the people, not the plot mechanics. And what could have been formula trash turns out to be fairly classy trash after all. Since the film's release, no number 6 train has ever been scheduled to leave Pelham Bay Park Station at either 1323 or 0123 by the New York City Transit Authority. This was policy for many years until it was discontinued. Although trains still aren't scheduled to leave the Pelham Bay Park Station at either 123 AM or PM, more out of superstition. And the film lives on in modern pop culture. Two remakes were spawned. First, a TV movie starring Edward James Olmos and Vincent D'Onofrio, and the Tony Scott feature starring Denzel Washington and John Travolta. Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs pays homage to Pelham with characters codenamed after colors. And the Beastie Boys song Sure Shot features the lyric, "Well, it's a taking off the Pelham, 1, 2, 3. If you wanna do the round, then come see me." And David Shire's score is now considered one of the greatest movie scores of all time. Joseph Sargent said, "We just thought we were doing another caper movie. We were making certain comments about society, but we also had humor built into it." Sargent would go on to be nominated for 9 Emmys, ultimately winning 3. He passed away in December of 2014 at the age of 89. After filming wrapped, Robert Shaw and Hector Elizondo appeared in August Strindberg's Dance of Death on Broadway in 1974. And a year after Pelham, Shaw would appear in a film that would cement his legacy, playing Quint in Steven Spielberg's Jaws. Elizondo says he feels a big gratitude towards Sargent and everyone that worked on the movie, and is still appearing on screens big and small today. Walter Matthau would continue to have a brilliant storied career after Pelham. He never won another Oscar after winning for The Fortune Cookie, but he would be nominated for 2 more, an Emmy, and 8 Golden Globes, winning in 1976 for Best Actor in a Motion Picture, Comedy or Musical for his role in The Sunshine Boys. Matthau's nearly 60-year career consists of memorable performances in films like The Bad News Bears, Hopscotch, JFK, and Grumpy Old Men. After years of battling heart conditions and pneumonia as an adult, Walter Matthau passed away on July 1st, 2000. And we're going to leave the final words to the editor of The Taking of Pelham 123, Jerry Greenberg, talking about the city in which they filmed. What is New York City on film? It's an invention. Thank you all so much for listening and supporting. My love goes out to each and every one of you. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at AK Donnelly. That's 1 N, 2 L's. My name is Anthony King, and I'll see y'all next time.